You're listening to KXL in the Morning on 1450 AM, 103.9 FM Concord, 101.9 FM Manchester, and nhtalkradio.com. I'm your host, AJ Kirstead. Let's get the latest in New Hampshire government news with our friends at the New Hampshire Bulletin. Get the articles at newhampshirebulletin.com. To join KXL in the Morning every Friday, this week I'm joined by writer Amanda Gokey. Welcome back.
Hi, AJ. Thanks for having me.
So let's start off with the piece that got a lot of attention yesterday, or Wednesday, actually. This is releasing Friday. I'm all out of sorts. So the Executive Council put up to discussion and vote on vaccination sites being expanded in the state. What was going on with that?
So there was a $7.2 million contract that was up for a vote yesterday. My colleague Amory Timmons was reporting on this. That would have allowed for six additional walk-in vaccination sites, which are in pretty high demand right now, with people really wanting to be able to access vaccines easily and without an appointment. So those sites would have been providing 15,000 shots a week. And there was a bit of a back and forth at the Executive Council, because though that contract was not put out to bid, it was a single source contract. And that was because of the timing, because the bidding process would have taken up to 3 months, time that the Department of Health and Human Services just felt it would have been better served to have those clinics up and running.
And this was going to be going to Convenient MD, if I'm correct, right?
Yeah. Yep. And so that Convenient MD did actually end up getting the contract, but that was only after a back and forth with three counselors voting against the contract because of the process and because they had wanted to see it go out to bid as opposed to just getting granted to Convenient MD. And Governor Sununu really pushed back on that in a bit of a testy exchange with Councillor Ted Gatsis, and basically just laid bare, you know, that voting against this contract would mean shutting down those six clinics effectively, something that I think nobody really wants to see happen right now. So they did get to the finish line. They did pass the contract eventually, but it was a bit of a close call on this one.
I mean, it seems to me like a lot of political posturing. Sununu is seen as kind of an establishment Republican still that's very, very pro-business. He has no problem buddying up with Convenient MD on this project to set up these sites. And Convenient MD is obviously more than willing to accept all the money that comes along with such business, because it gives them tons of PR and they're a rapidly expanding business over the last decade in the state. I mean, what was the point that Gatsis and such were making? Is it just strictly, hey, you didn't follow this procedure? Or is there something more specific they weren't happy about?
Yeah, I think it really was about the bidding process. It seemed like that was the major sticking point, that they were trying to turn the focus to that. But I think ultimately it was clear from the vote that that wasn't a winning strategy. Just the pressures of the pandemic and kind of outweighed the importance of that process in this particular instance.
Yeah, that'd be some terrible PR for the Executive Council. It's already been having a ton of negative PR of late around the Rebuild NH crew. If they decided to continue with not allowing these sites to go up, it would have been, I think it would have been catastrophic for the anti-establishment Republicans in the party, because these sites are needed. It's anecdotally, like, to find a booster shot for my wife. I was very fortunate to get one at my full-time job, but my wife had to schedule weeks. The vaccination site is incorrect when it says there are drop-ins available. There are no drop-ins available in Concord pharmacies. You need to schedule an appointment. Target sign up in front of their site says you need to schedule an appointment. So to be able to have sites like this where you can go up is very important to get more people vaccinated.
Yeah, and Concord is one of the sites that's going to be getting now one of the first five. So Concord, Keene, Manchester, Nashua, and Salem are going to be the first five to receive these sites and hopefully address some of that need that you were describing, AJ. And additionally, later in the day, at the sort of weekly COVID press update, We did learn that there's going to be another round of the booster blitz, sort of these massive across the state, 14 locations. Similarly, you do have to sign up in advance to get an appointment for these, but there's going to be 13,000 spots. So hopefully that will make a dent in getting people who are trying to get an appointment, struggling to get one. This is sort of meant to clear that, help clear out that backlog for people.
And from a science and medical perspective, it seems like the booster is likely the most important thing right now as opposed to those initial vaccines. Everyone should get the initial vaccine, but we're already in the middle, if not hopefully past the hump of the largest outbreak we've had in the state since the virus began. So if to be able to get boosters out there is important. If you're looking to get a booster, try and figure it out now, because now's the time to sort it out.
And the state epidemiologist, Dr. Ben Chan, was driving that point home yesterday as well, and saying, you know, with Omicron, the boosters are especially important to provide that additional protection against this new variant that we're seeing 9 confirmed cases so far in the state. But Chan was saying that the real number is likely much higher. It's just a matter of testing and detecting those cases.
Yeah, it's super interesting to try and figure out what exactly is going on with what virus is actually taking over the states, because it was literally within a week, some states, like half their viruses were related to Omicron. It just was rapidly expanding. I mean, hopefully it means we're going to reach a certain level of immunity to the virus here quick, but we're still dealing with Delta in New Hampshire. We have a handful of the Omicron, but Omicron, fortunately, is less severe, but Delta's here right now. So if you want to avoid Delta, like California and New York were dealing with 3 or 4 months ago, get your vaccines.
And, you know, the other thing that we're looking at now is the holidays. Obviously, a lot of people planning to get together with family, some folks traveling. So there's a couple of precautions that people can take. Obviously, a booster is one of those, just to provide additional protection from against all variants. The state's also going to be sending out more of those at-home tests. They announced yesterday 750,000 additional at-home tests. These will be available to people who didn't get them in the first round. Those tests went super fast last time. They were the supply was gone in less than 24 hours. So clearly there's a strong desire by folks to get tested. And especially if you're going to be seeing a relative that's older, that sounds like those tests are more accurate if you're symptomatic. They can sort of determine, like, is it a cold or is it COVID? But also a precaution you can take if you don't have symptoms and just want to have that extra peace of mind before you gather with family. Dr. Chan mentioned the importance of ventilation. That's still something that you can do if you're gathering indoors with family. Crack a window, turn on your bathroom or kitchen ventilation systems. That can help a lot, just keeping the air moving. Masking is still always an option if you're around somebody who's especially high risk. So things like that are important to keep in mind as folks start gathering with family members and loved ones.
And definitely suggest everyone who's interested in either the rapid test, the booster blitz, or just in general getting more information on COVID-19 in the state, go to covid19.nh.gov. It's covid19.nh.gov. They literally have a big button at the front that says free at home rapid tests and booster blitz. So if you're looking for either of those, can't miss them. So go do that now. Moving over to the energy department in the state, something that's still kind of weird to have at the state level for many people, including myself. But there's been some questioning going on with regards to the advocate regarding it. So what's going on there?
Yeah, so this has been a big sort of case unraveling. A pretty controversial decision was made back in November by the Public Utilities Commission, basically cutting. They first rejected a 3-year energy efficiency plan that had been put together. It was a consensus process with the utilities, environmental groups, the consumer advocate. So a lot of people had worked to put together a plan they all agreed on, and then waited about almost a year to get this decision after the plan was supposed to first take place. The Utilities Commission ended up deciding to reject that plan. And in addition to that, they cut funding. So that's sort of the backdrop. But right now what we have is there's questions about who's going to, there's been a lot of pushback to that initial decision. So the utilities have filed a motion saying, hey, what's going on with this? We don't fully understand what your decision meant and how we can operate these programs. And the programs are running through what's called NH Saves, and basically doing things like home weatherization, just kind of common sense measures that make a house more efficient. So you're spending less on your energy bill, but you're also reducing demand for energy, which can lower rates for everybody in the state. And the question right now that's really being debated is who is going to be making this decision. There's people on the commission who have previous involvement that could create a conflict. And so yesterday, the executive council heard a nomination for what's called a special commissioner, because the commission is made up of three people who are supposed to be decision makers on these cases. And they need at least two people to be able to make a decision. So, staffer from the PUC, Ann Ross, was nominated yesterday. The consumer advocate said this could set a bad precedent because she is currently a staffer underneath the chair. So he was questioning whether she would be able to have true independence in making these decisions, or if she would be swayed because, you know, if you're all of a sudden at the table with somebody who is your direct boss, I think that was the question that he was raising.
It's always messy when they're looking to add a new department or add a department that's related to another one, because you do have that conflict of interest. But the people coming from that related department or have dealt with things in that industry are going to be the most informed on it. I mean, we saw this a lot, especially, I mean, Trump's selections for his heads of different departments was a prime example of there was so many complaints of there's all these longtime bureaucrats that have no real experience doing anything, being under Obama and such, and then Trump went the polar opposite and got all these millionaire executives to take over the same role. And it's whenever you're trying to start a new department, there's going to be these growing pains like this.
Yeah, and I think experience is an important sort of qualifier in some of these cases. Is certainly there's been issues and experience is something people are really looking at and questioning. So the special commissioner, Ann Ross, does have a lot of experience in the department. So that's something she certainly has going for her. But the chair of the commission, Dan Goldner, who signed off on the sort of November decision cutting funding for energy efficiency, his background is in business. And so there's not necessarily the deep engagement with energy regulatory framework, which can be really, really technical and kind of complicated.
Yeah.
So there's also the other piece of this is on the 27th, there's going to be a hearing in the Superior Court for a lawsuit that Clean Energy New Hampshire and some energy contractors, as well as the town of Hanover, brought forward. So they'll have about an hour. They're going to be hearing arguments from both sides. The state is essentially, in its response, is arguing that this is the wrong forum and that it should be heard at the PUC and not at the Superior Court.
Yeah. Is there any pushback to the fact they're trying to do this in the middle of the pandemic at this point? Or is it basically people that are dedicated to this are like, we have the bandwidth?
Well, so yeah, and that's been kind of both sides have taken that pandemic argument from the beginning. I mean, the original plan that was put together, this triennial plan, it was really ambitious. And so it did mean it's funded from ratepayers. So in your electric bill, you have something called the system benefits charge. That would have gone up slightly. For your average household, it would have been the difference of a couple dollars a month. But for big businesses, that could have been a pretty hefty charge. And so people who were opposed to that plan argued the pandemic's not the right time to increase these rates. Now, on the flip side, you have people, you know, saying, well, you're cutting these really important, this really important program. You're going to leave people in the cold, in the dark during the pandemic, in a winter that it's going to be especially high heating costs, as we know, with the cost of natural gas just skyrocketing. Electricity is also going up as a result of that. So both sides are kind of trying to take that pandemic angle and add it to their arguments.
Yeah, is there especially with all the people not necessarily back to work for whatever reason. I mean, we still have the severe labor shortage, so that has to have an impact when it comes to income coming into those in poverty in the state. So, and those are the people more likely to be owning or leasing a piece of property that isn't necessarily insulated appropriately for the severe weather. I mean, you're talking modular homes from the 50s through 80s that maybe not have been upgraded appropriately. They may not have a great roof. That doesn't help. And having programs like this would be very helpful to them.
That's completely right. And that is something that some of those low-income programs have been impacted and halted as a result of this decision, which is certainly cause for concern for some people watching this case develop.
So we just got a couple minutes left on this, but I want to just touch on this article you have. It's been really difficult for new farmers that are looking to purchase property, just like anyone else that's wanting to start a business in the state. But it must be very unique for people in the agricultural field.
Yeah, that's right. And I think that farmers, like everybody else, have felt that crunch of the just increased cost for looking at a piece of land. One thing that was really interesting, I sort of assumed that price would be the major barrier for folks trying to get their start at farming. And it is a big barrier, but another major issue that comes up is just communication with landowners. Because if owning land isn't possible, if you don't have the finances to do that, a lot of farmers actually lease the land. But that requires these kind of very involved contracts and lease agreements with landowners about what exactly is allowed. What can you build on the land? What are you allowed to do with the land? Are you spraying pesticides? Are you not spraying pesticides? There's kind of all these huge questions. And so I learned there's this nonprofit in the state called Land for Good, and they help these landowners on one hand, and also the potential farmers on the other, just to hammer out what those agreements look like, what are the terms that they're agreeing to, and just think of all this sort of laundry list of issues that might arise. One of the farmers I spoke with, Andal Sundaramuti, was mentioning like concerns like, okay, I'm going to spend all this money, you know, building out a well and doing all of these improvements to the property. What happens if I have a fall? What happens if I break my back? So she was thinking even of like these big health concerns, which, you know, if you're doing anyone who does physical labor, those are real, although very unfortunate, you know, possibilities to contemplate when you're looking down this sort of a career path.
There's a ton of regulatory zoning. There's tons of like whose income is going where, what income needs to be put towards what when you're going into a commercial environment. People just assume, oh, I've got a little plot out back, why can't I just start selling it? Well, if you want to go commercial, there's tons of implications from a legal and regulatory perspective you got to deal with.
Yeah, and this is kind of an interesting issue too, in that it's kind of coming up now as the folks who are going into farming there's some shift in who's doing it. So I think in the past, the model was traditionally like your parents are farmers, you inherit the family farm, you grow up you doing it, learning all of those sort of tricks of the trade. And then that land is kind of passed on in that way. But now what we're seeing is people who have a master's degree and they're dissatisfied with their professions and decide like, hey, I would like to be a part of promoting local agriculture. I think that's important. It aligns with my values. And so people are coming to it from a different angle, and they don't necessarily have their family's farm and that land automatically available to them. And that's where this kind of challenge is really arising.
Yeah, it was an overcompensation. I really feel like in the education industry, whether it's K-12 or higher ed, with regards to we're just going to do knowledge base for everything, or we're going to focus on liberal arts, when there's just like for the plumber industry and electrician industry, there is that side when it comes to agriculture that's completely spaced. I mean, there may be, especially on the people that grow up poor, they may end up working on the farm, baling hay and such, and that might be their end. But for many, many people, with all the people that moved to the cities over the last couple decades, there's a big barrier to make it over into this field.
Yeah, and I think for people who are in cities, you're seeing the folks at this nonprofit, Land for Good, were telling me, you know, they're seeing people who want to do an urban garden, or they've got the urban garden and they want to find land outside the city. So even in more urban areas, and especially interesting for me to learn about was the south of the state. You know, the land is obviously more expensive there, or can be more expensive there. You know, flat land is sort of the ideal for many of these farming ventures, but it's also the place where people want to build a house. So it's in direct competition with development pressures, and that can drive prices up, that can make it harder for farmers to get on the land. But that land's also valuable to farmers because it's really close to their markets. So I talked with some folks at a really cool creamery dairy called Benedict Dairy, which is in Goffstown. And they were saying, you know, they're selling raw milk, and so it's a perishable product. They don't want to have to drive hours and hours on the road to deliver it to their client base. And so for them, the right place was to be closer to some of those urban centers of, you know, Manchester and not far afield from Nashua. They said they have some people who come up from Boston every weekend to buy their product, and they're leasing that land.
Reporter Amanda Gokhiv, New Hampshire Bulletin. Get more from them at newhampshirebulletin.com. You're listening to WKXL in the morning.